with Bigfoot, there's enough evidence, you know, with fecal material, with footprints, with eyewitness accounts, with traditions, that if it was actually a case of murder, you could have sent somebody to the electric chair several times over.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Knoll of America!
I wonder if we're going to learn more about the Thunderbirds by having some new fossil discoveries that will really kind of shake up science in general. The Tazoverm are these 4-foot-long, almost like a giant beaded lizard, that are often reported in the Alps. The other thing that a lot of people don't know is that there's actually enough water in Loch Ness to bury everyone on Earth under 6 feet of water.
Oh, wow.
This is the kind of information you get, folks, from Lauren Coleman, not just on the show, but when you go to the museum, he'll tell you these stories that even I've never heard. Amazing stuff.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big thanks to our buddy Pete Diggins for providing the theme music to this installment of the program. Check out his website, aurophonic.com, and that's spelled AuroPhonic.com. One minor in-house note here this week on the program. We were scheduled to have Cullen O'Reilly on the program this week, but I actually shifted things around at the last minute, called an audible, and decided to run this fantastic interview with Lauren Coleman. Wanted to time it for the big relocation of Lauren's International Cryptozoology Museum. But wouldn't you know, this being BOA Audio, of course, I had the episode all lined up for you, was really very close to having it to you, and we got nailed with this winter storm, knocked the power out at BOA HQ, and the episode was sort of sitting there half done while I waited for things to resume. Anyway, that's sort of to catch you up on where we're at here as we go into this installment of the program. As noted, our guest is the iconic Lauren Coleman, and we have finally got him back on the program after a nearly 5-year absence to talk about pure cryptozoology. Of course, we've had him on for the baseball special, but we only had him on to talk crypto stuff way back in season 1. So this is a big, big, big return to the program by Lauren Coleman. Very excited to have this episode for you folks. I have been waiting to talk to Lauren about pure cryptozoology for so long, so when I finally got the chance to sit down and talk to him, we just covered a myriad of areas. Really, this is an in-depth and richly arrayed conversation covering cryptozoology, not just from the land, but also the sea and air. Over the course of the next 90 minutes or so, you're going to hear us talk about Lauren's amazing International Cryptozoology Museum, covering it from a whole bunch of different angles. Then, of course, since I am a massive Bigfoot aficionado, we're going to have a lengthy discussion on my own personal white whale. And we're going to get into the state of Bigfoot research. Where do we stand on proving the existence of this mysterious beast? And as noted, land, sea, air, we're going to cover a veritable menagerie of cryptids, including the Orang Pendek, Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, Champ, the Abominable Snowman, Ogopogo, the Montauk Monster, Alien Big Cats, Chupacabras, Thunderbirds, and even the Tazoverm. That is just a crypto zoo of creatures here, my friends, and we're going to talk about all of them on the program. It is a conversation that spans the pantheon of cryptozoology's most famous and infamous creatures, as well as providing a look at the current state of the science with the legendary Lauren Coleman. For those folks out there who are unfamiliar with Lauren Coleman, I feel bad for you because he is one of the all-time greats in the world of not just cryptozoology, but esoterica as a whole, and I'm going to try and provide you with just a bit of background on him. Lauren Coleman is one of the world's leading cryptozoologists, some say the leading. Certainly, he is acknowledged as the current living American researcher and writer who has most popularized cryptozoology in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Starting his field work and investigations in 1960, after traveling and trekking extensively in pursuit of cryptozoological mysteries, Coleman began writing to share his experiences soon after his first expeditions. His first cryptozoology magazine article was published in 1969, when he was 21 years old. His first book was published in 1975. Today, Coleman has written more than 6,000 columns and articles, as well as over 35 books. He's appeared frequently on radio and television programs and has lectured throughout North America, as well as in London and at Loch Ness. Two of his newest books for 2011 are Monsters of New Jersey with Bruce Hallenbeck and True Giants with Mark Hall. Lauren established his International Cryptozoology Museum in 2003 in his home, and he extended beyond merely receiving media and research guests by appointment when the museum went public in 2009. After 2 years of massive media coverage, the museum relocated to an all-new location, befitting its growing popularity. Lauren Coleman's websites are www.cryptomundo.com, that's spelled CryptoMundo.com, and the International Cryptozoology Museum's website is www.cryptozoologymuseum.com. Pretty simple, all one word, cryptozoologymuseum.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on October 17th, 2011. Lauren Coleman joins us for an in-depth cryptozoology conversation on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. I am just supremely excited about this edition of the program. It's one we've been trying to actually put together for quite a while. My guest, I could just talk all day with hyperbole. I mean, you know, in the world of the paranormal, he's an icon. Okay, he is the face and voice of cryptozoology, not just to America, but really the world. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer, one of the all-time greats. And he's also one of my good friends, something that I never would have even thought could happen 10 years ago when I picked up his book, Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America. And since that time, you know, I've had the chance to hang out with him. I've had the chance to talk to him. He's been on the show numerous times, but only once for a full-length cryptozoology discussion, and that was back in February of 2006. So it's been way too long since we had this conversation again. Of course, I am talking about the iconic Lauren Coleman. He's the man behind the International Cryptozoology Museum. Big news about that we're going to be getting into right away. And, of course, the massively popular blog, Cryptomundo.com. And he's the author of how many books is it at this point, Lauren? What's the count now?
About 35.
About 35 books. So just an unbelievable career in this field. And as I said, it's thrilling for me to have him back on the show for this conversation. Lauren, welcome back to BOA Audio. It's been too long.
Tim, it's great talking to you. It does seem amazing to me that it's not been since 2006 that we've in-depth talked about cryptozoology. Well, you know, one thing is great about our friendship. It has even outlasted the MASH monster marathons, right? Yes. We outlasted little get-togethers that used to happen in Massachusetts. And some friendships really do go beyond little incidental meetings.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. We promise, trust me, Lauren and I do not want to talk at all about the Red Sox here tonight, folks. So there will be no Red Sox discussion. But, you know, the cool thing about our friendship, too, is just that, you know, I always sort of measure these friendships in the paranormal by the ratio of how much you talk about the paranormal to what you don't talk about, you know, the normal stuff. And it seems our conversations always revolve around sports at this point. So it's gone on that long. Well, let's talk about, of course, the big thing, the International Cryptozoology Museum. Coming up, of course, on the two-year anniversary, but you've got this big move going on, the grand reopening on October 30th, 2011. Talk about, you know, what's going on with the museum.
Well, you know what occurred, of course, the museum itself was created in 2003 with two primary missions. One, to really preserve and respect the history of cryptozoology. I was hearing about so many collections that were being ditched into dumpsters and being trashed and being forgotten. And then also, I, of course, had a massive collection that a lot of documentary film companies, a lot of reality TV and researchers wanted to see. So I organized it into a museum in 2003 in Portland, Maine, in 4.5 rooms in my home. And I would have different people in. And then, of course, as anything happens with the new age of the Internet, people started asking me if they could come visit, and it really got to be overwhelming. I had a couple teenage boys that were growing into young men, and, you know, even before they went to college, it was kind of a hassle to try to figure out where's the living space that they can be secure in, and then where are all these public people that wanted to come in and look at the museum. So finally, I started putting out the feelers, and in 2009, I was at a conference up in Maine, and Michelle Soliner, who eventually created the Green Hand Books, she said, I'm moving into a place on Congress Street in downtown Portland. There's a room at the back of it. Would you like to have your museum there? And I jumped at the chance and put all of my major artifacts, evidence, different things, actually turned out to be at over 2,000 items into 500 square feet. And it was overwhelming for some people, but for most people, they really enjoyed it. They came through. But then I signed a 3-year lease, and I thought, oh, you know, at the end of this 3 years, I'll definitely want to move. Well, it turned out at the end of 2 years, I just needed to move. It was just too small. We were too successful. We were getting people from New Zealand, from Australia, from England, Germany. I counted in the last 2 weeks. We were the destination site for 7 different honeymoon couples.
Oh, my God.
There was some people came in a week ago. They had just got married in Madrid, Spain, and they decided to come over to New England. And the very first place they wanted to come was the International Cryptozoology Museum.
Wow.
As it turns out, they'd heard me on a podcast over in Spain. I've been on, you know, the museum and myself have been on U.S. Navy television, a podcast and television show in Italy, one in Germany, one in Spain. And so our international acclaim, so to speak, is getting to be so much that people are getting married and they're coming here for their honeymoons. And it just, we needed to move. We needed to move. And so we've moved out of, we're moving out of this space that's, you know, under 500 feet, square feet. And we're moving into a space that is about 4 times, 5 times as big as where we're at. We also, in the last 2 months, have filed for and been granted nonprofit corporation status in the state of Maine, and we're doing all of the continued filing to get the IRS 501c3. So it's just the amazing thing is that the museum is just becoming more and more well-known, more and more successful. I mean, we're on, I heard about from all of these people from all over the world that were mentioned in Lonely Planet. We're on the Huffington Post top 7 weird places in the United States to go see. We were in Reader's Digest in the main issue in Yankee Magazine, Quirky Spot of New England. So it's just, I mean, I didn't even really try for any of this, and I just wanted to say, here's the collection. It's organized, lots of signs, lots of tours, lots of, you know, real evidence of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, Orange, Pendek, Yowie, a Tasmanian tiger, real hair samples, real foot casts, all of those things. And before I know it, you know, just it's got all of this promotional publicity, insights, write-ups, reviews, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's just amazing. The media coverage of this has been massive. And just, you know, as a friend and as a fan of cryptozoology, it's like so gratifying to see, you know, and it's for the most part positive. Of course, you get some of the jokey aspect. You're always going to get that with paranormal coverage, but just to get the word out like this in so many outlets is amazing.
Right. And it's even been for the skeptics. A lot of skeptics have been surprised about how skeptical I am, or a lot of popular cultural anthropologists to come through here and really began to really understand that we don't have toys here. We have artifacts that might have a cultural background to them. And, you know, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are actually the Kappas from Japanese folklore. And so a lot of people are understanding that, or like the what's behind the jackalope or the fur-bearing trout or the Fiji mermaid, which are rogue taxidermy items of cryptozoology. So it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's very scientific as a baseline. And, of course, here to take a metaphor from baseball, if we build it, they will come, and it really did happen. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that is the amazing part, too. And it's like it's a you have a really unique sort of like research opportunity, almost on a sociological level, too, because you know, the people come to you to see this stuff. So you get a pretty good idea, you know, of the cross-section of people that are interested in this. And I'm sure it ranges from, you know, lay people who are curious all the way up to ardent cryptozoologists and then the skeptics. I mean, what's it been like just to sort of see this wave of people come in?
Well, it's just amazing. I ask every person that comes through some preliminary demographic questions because I individualize the orientation for every person. So in those 3 to 5 questions that I ask people, I can find out if they're a lifelong cryptozoologist or if they're somebody off of a cruise ship and they saw us on a map and they were tired of the art museums or the lobster shack, so they wanted to go to someplace unique that's only in Portland and really only here as the only international cryptozoology museum in the world. So it's been quite enlightening to see, you know, some people come in and they've read my books, they know my name, and I'm not exaggerating, they literally start crying because they're meeting me. I mean, I as you well know, and I just think I'm a common, ordinary person that just happened to write the books and pull together thoughts to share on cryptozoology. And of course, now I'm seen as I jokingly say to people, I'm often called the world's leading living cryptozoologist. But for me, the most important phrase is that I'm living.
Exactly.
And so I, you know, everybody can be the greatest. I just wanted to make sure I shared all of this before I kicked the bucket. So here it is. And I still go out. You know, I just returned from a 3,000-mile road trip to Illinois in which I stopped in Indiana, investigated the giant turtle reports. I stopped in New York and investigated some old Black Panther reports at the Van Eaton Swamp. You know, and in Pennsylvania, I went and looked at the territory in Fayette County where there's Bigfoot reports. So I'm still out there in the field. Just because I have a museum, I haven't stopped being field research worthy, as well as, a documentary film programs called me up and they say, can we fly you to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, as Discovery Channel's William Shatner's Weirder What did last spring. So I'm still doing all of that. I'm still, being in the museum sometimes and then also writing books. So I've never been so active in my life, actually. So it's great. It's great to be alive.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic to hear. And you know, I've remarked to people too when I'm talking about the museum, one of the greatest things in the museum is you, because like you said, you tailor this, you even tailor the presentation to what the people are looking for. I mean, this is like, you're not just going to the International Cryptozoology Museum. You're getting the full Monty here from the guy who really is, as I said, the face and voice of cryptozoology. It's worth the trip alone, you know. So I enjoyed it thoroughly. I can't wait to see the new space. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you do with that.
Yeah, I surprise a lot of people. You know, they tell me they're from Oakland County, Michigan, and I just have this little filing system in my head, and I say, oh, yeah, the site of 1969 Black Panther reports. And they just look at me like, you know, I either have 3 eyes or something. But once in a blue moon, they say, oh, yeah, you know, my mother actually saw that, and we never told anybody. You know, we read about it in the paper, but we saw it too. And it just, it's amazing how, like the other day, I was telling the story of Ruth Harkness and the discovery of the giant panda, and the woman standing there, and she all of a sudden says, wow, That's amazing. I never thought that I'd come here and you would have talked about Ruth Harkness, because my grandmother was the woman that had all of Ruth Harkness's letters, and the lady in the panda, she was in the movie, she was in the book, and I'm the granddaughter of the woman that knew Ruth Harkness. So it's like these incredible connections that happen all the time. People coming here and then finding out they are part of the exhibit.
And the other part of it that's really fantastic, sort of going along with the research opportunity aspect of it too, is like, up until now, we really didn't have this sort of clearinghouse for stuff. Like, if this lady had material that you want, like, where would you give that stuff to? Now it can be sent to Lawrence Museum, so it can be preserved. Like you said, so people's collections and stuff don't go tossed in the trash or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, and that, and one of the things that I've tried to really instill in people is I don't care if they give it to this museum, but I want them to really understand the archives in cryptozoology should be given to their alumni, to their local library, their foundation, whatever. We, of course, would like to have it for the museum to share it with other people. And so, for instance, the artist in North Carolina just recently had a show here in Portland, and he just donated a dozen paintings that are unique to cryptozoology to the new museum. A man who, a researcher, who made a lifelong obsession to collect every jackalope postcard and other kind of fake and folkloric cards with jackalopes and fur bearing trout. And he's dying of cancer in Germany, and he just donated his three notebooks of all of those postcards to our museum so we can exhibit them. So it's quite exciting that people are really understanding that there's a history here. And for instance, before he died, one of the researchers that was connected to this Tom Flick expeditions, he donated the hair samples, the fecal material,
the
skin samples to our museum. And in fact, you know, it kind of comes around that happened a few years ago. And on October 25th, for instance, Travel Channel is doing a special on the Tom Slick fecal material samples that are in this museum on their program, Mysteries at the Museum. And, you know, those shows that go on those documentary channels, they're just repeated forever. Mm-hmm. So we're really putting into the documentary history all of this material that kind of was always forgotten.
It's just amazing. It's absolutely amazing when you step back and just see the totality of what's going on here with this museum. It's just fantastic. I'm just so happy for you that it's turned out to be such a success. Just thrilled.
Thank you.
Now, it's been 5 years, as I said, since we've – more, five and a half now, since we had the last full-length crypto conversation here on the show. Let's sort of dive a little bit in here now to the world of cryptozoology. And, you know, I consider Bigfoot sort of like my white whale. Even though I have an interest in UFOs, I just passionately have an interest in Bigfoot and sort of getting to the bottom of this mystery. And we've seen – a real stunning sort of raising of public awareness of Bigfoot since we talked, even not just with like Monster Quest, but even with these sort of like silly messing with Sasquatch commercials and stuff. It's like Bigfoot is hot, really hot. But at the same time, you know, I'm wondering where we are on a practical level on our quest to actually solve the Bigfoot puzzle. So, I mean, so let's talk a little bit. There's two things going on in that question, but I think you can kind of understand where I'm going. You know, where are we really with getting to the bottom of this as it parallels this amazing resurgence in interest?
Well, I think on one level, we've really come to grips with the fact that long-term, the major quest for Bigfoot is still ongoing. And part of the problem, of course, is funding. During the Victorian era, one of the reasons we were able to pursue things like the giant panda, the mountain gorilla, and some of these larger unknown animals in Africa and Asia, was that you had museums and you had zoological parks that were interested in proving if these creatures actually existed, adding them to their collections and all of that. So you would have people in the field for 6 months at a time. Now we're in the age of, you know, we used to say MTV, but it's really the internet, it's Twitter, it's, you know, instant thoughts, instant email, instant messaging, and TV programs that are interested in funding some searches for Bigfoot. But how do they do it? They do it by sending someone into the field for 3 days.
Yeah.
So the frustrating part is there's never been a higher interest in Bigfoot, but there's never been lower actual funding for the searches. You also have a lot of possible secret projects going on. A lot of people are talking about the Erickson Project or other projects that are funding Jeff Meldrum and things like that. But long term, we're going to have to be patient, because if there's a real project going on where they're testing DNA and they're testing hair samples, they're not going to rush to have a news conference like we saw with the Georgia hoax in 2008. Those people were promoters. They were trying to make money. They did actually make $50,000 off of a construction owner in Indiana. He never got his money back. And they were just interested in spending the money on fast cars and fast women. So we never saw it, it recycled back into Bigfoot research. Whereas Meldrum and some other people were actually quietly getting grants and doing some hard work. But we'll have to wait until their peer-reviewed papers are published, and we'll know if there's anything real there. In the meantime, I don't see any long-term really placing – see, I think that the way that Bigfoot will eventually be proven is by having a woman or several women placed in the field for 6 months at a time. The pheromones that human males send off really do send the great apes going in the other direction. So the experience of Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, and all of the female researchers that really have worked with great apes needs to be replicated by female humans looking for Bigfoot.
Wow. See, this is fascinating. This is a completely different take than I would have expected to hear, but it obviously very logical and well thought out. So, yeah, very interesting.
And there was actually a woman a couple years ago. I supported her getting grants. She was an artist in California, and she wanted to do a sort of a performance art situation that she called Finding Bigfoot. She was going to go into the woods for 6 weeks, and through a satellite uplink, constantly had a video camera on and video texting to her supporters and to her professors and different things to try to be in touch with wildlife. And maybe just by being in one place, Bigfoot would come to her. So I got her sponsorships. I got her equipment. I did all of those kinds of things. And then she got out in the field, and I could see from the uplink some very disappointing a disappointing situation occurred. Finally, she got back from her 6 weeks out in the woods, not having any close-up experiences with Bigfoot. And I asked her what I eventually had to ask her, which was, why did she bring a dog along? And she said she brought a dog along because she was afraid as a single female out in the woods. Unfortunately, all of us know the one animal that you never take with you if you're trying to find Bigfoot, you know, in a camping situation or a stakeout situation, is a dog, because Bigfoot have a natural animosity against the canids. They've been known to kill them, to rip them from limb to limb, to really get in fights with them. It may be the old wolf versus Bigfoot kind of syndrome, but I found that unfortunate, and so I told her, I said, I wish you would have let me know that. I would have suggested to go out in the field with two women or three women, but never to take a dog. It's almost as illogical as when you hear about weekend Joes, you know, six-pack Joes going out to find Bigfoot, and they're smoking cigarettes, because the smoking of the cigarette sends the Bigfoot going the other direction, too. So, you know, there's lots of elementary things that I think will lead to the finding of Bigfoot. Of course, the other kind of Harry and the Henderson syndrome is that we may discover Bigfoot when a lumber truck hits one.
Yeah.
So that is the other possibility. But I do think that it's going to be a woman that eventually makes contact. I am a little upset, however, by what I see. You know, since you're a student of ufology, you know that one of the undermining elements of ufology, as sort of scientific ufology, was the whole phase of UFO contactees.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, the Bigfoot history of recent years has gone into what we call Bigfoot contactees.
I've noticed a little bit of that. Yeah, I've noticed a little bit of that. People who say that they're having contact with Bigfoot. I mean, there's no other way to couch the term, right? I mean, so, yeah, saying...
Yeah, there's a very big story that was in all of the newspapers last week, you know, during October. And it was a situation where a woman, and I'll just use her first name, Robin, said that she actually got funding to go over to Russia to a conference that was over in Russia to talk to the people there. She says she's been in contact with a family of 10 Bigfoot for 2 years in Michigan, and that they love her blueberry bagels. And she says she knows that that's their favorite food, so whenever she isn't able to bake them, she goes around to other stores in the area of Michigan where she lives and tells everybody that she's getting the bagels for wildlife. And, you know, but Jeff Melder, myself, and others have really questioned this whole situation with her. If you're in contact with Bigfoot for 2 years, or the woman in Tennessee who said she was in contact with the family of Bigfoot for 50 years, where's the proof?
Right.
Where's the photographs? Where's the fecal material? Jeff Meldrum, the reporter, myself, you know, the least you can get in a very unintrusive way is to pick up fecal material. I mean, if you're saying you don't want to take their picture because you feel like you're intruding on them, or you can't get hair samples and different things like that, there's absolutely nothing. You know, if it's a real biological being, it has to do a bit of defecation in the woods. So you pick up the fecal material and you prove to everybody that you have DNA of Bigfoot.
Right.
And so it's been disappointing over and over again. We're hearing these big contactee stories, and unfortunately there's certain people in Russia and in the United States that feel that these Bigfoot are in telepathic communication with humans.
Yeah, then it gets into real strange stuff, right?
That the woman in Tennessee was saying that they speak in a human-like lingo, that it can be interpreted as a form of Cherokee. So it just gets, I mean, literally more and more crazy, and becomes like the UFO contactees, in which you begin to wonder if they're going to say that they came from the planet Venus, you know, as the next step.
Right, right. Now, you talked about sort of what you called, what you termed, I guess you could say, like secret studies that might be going on. But are these the sort of situations where, you know, we may get half the foot through the door, in a sense, where we're going to get some peer-reviewed paper and admirably done, you know, obviously, and that will sort of say, yes, there's a creature that exists, you know, that we've cross-sectioned with all this DNA from all these things, but we don't have the body or anything like that. Almost like Bigfoot's real, but we can't go all the way with it yet. Is that kind of what you think may happen with these sort of peer-reviewed papers that are being written?
Well, some of us are somewhat suspicious of some of the things we're hearing, because they're saying, well, it seems like the DNA is showing this is a human-like creature. Well, you know, the contamination of DNA with human skin cells is quite frequent. So we have to be very skeptical of these studies in which they're saying they're writing peer-reviewed journal articles, and yet they're not going to show us all the information. They need to be challenged by cryptozoologists from inside the field just as much by the skeptics and debunkers from outside the field. We really have to have a high standard. The eventual proof of Bigfoot has to be a body, dead or alive. You don't really have any leeway anymore, because with the name Bigfoot, which has become such a silly name, that anthropologists are really holding Bigfoot studies to a higher standard. We have the the discovery of new species in Africa of monkeys, for instance, purely based upon videotape. Some other places, of course, you have the debate ongoing about does the ivory-billed woodpecker exist, and all they have is a video and some sound recordings. But with Bigfoot, there's enough evidence, you know, with fecal material, with footprints, with eyewitness accounts, with traditions, that if it was actually a case of murder, you could have sent somebody to the electric chair several times over. But it's not enough proof for scientists, for zoologists, for anthropologists to say Bigfoot exists. So since we're in that situation, we have to really go with the rules that have been set up and work a little harder to come up with a body or a body part or a live capture. I'm very much a no-kill New Age anthropologist in terms of it's not really necessary to do the James Audubon thing and completely kill out the species to prove they exist.
Right, right. I always feel, too, kind of like that once we get the one Bigfoot, all of a sudden it's somehow going to become easier that we'll see. If a Bigfoot gets hit by a truck, all of a sudden, next thing you know, it'll be somehow more easy to not just capture or just prove it in a way. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like once one domino falls, all of a sudden we're going to get a lot more information.
Yeah, I think the floodgates will open and a lot of the rejection of past evidence. We'll have a lot of people bringing out shelves and drawers full of evidence that they really didn't want to talk about, and then you'll see how it all of these pieces will fit together. I think even if we have a discovery of the Orangay Pindek, which is a little bipedal ape over in Sumatra, if that happens in the next 25 years, as I've written about, I think it's the best bet to be discovered. In many ways, I think that's going to really change a lot of perception. And you've already really seen it a little bit when the Homo forensis, the hobbits, were discovered in 2003.
Right, right. You think it's going to take 25 years for the Orang Pendek? Because we've had Adam Davies on the show three times now, and I'm fascinated by his work. Because he seems like he's getting closer and closer. Like, I'd put it almost at 5 years, but maybe I'm being too optimistic.
Well, I think Adam, who's been there, who's been in the middle of it, has a little bit of the participant-observer addiction. I mean, I really like Adam. I'm also for his work, and I really support it. The museum has first-generation cast of the Orangay Pindek footprint from his 2001 expedition. So I'm a very pro Adam Davies guy, kind of guy. I wrote an introduction to his book. But I think, you know, to be a conservative cryptozoologist in, say, 25 years versus sort of almost too hopeful to say it's going to be in 5 years.
Yeah, that was prediction, not Adam.
Yeah. and I think that, I mean, it was in 1985 that I helped write the letter to the Indonesian government for Deborah Marter, who's been over there since 85. She needed someone who, was at a university like I was at the time to support her visa so she could get in there. And she said, you know, I've been there since 85. I've seen Orangay Pindek three times, and I've seen the Sumatran rhino two times. We know the Sumatran rhino exists, and I know that the Orangay Pindek exists, but we don't have final proof yet. And so even though those researchers have been there, and Adam and Debbie and others have found footprints and hair samples and all of that, it's still just barely on the edge of the quest. So I have to be... It's sort of like building the pyramid. It takes a long, long time,
yeah.
And we really have to have patience.
All right. I'll try to be more patient.
No, that's all right. I'm hopeful, too. I would certainly like to see a big discovery before I turn 100.
Just to go down a really weird road, I stumbled across this somewhere. I forget where now, but I heard somewhere that after Mount St. Helens erupted that the government, like, secretly came in and took away a bunch of Bigfoot bodies. You must have heard this rumor before. Is there, obviously, if there's any truth to it, this conversation would be completely different, but what's that whole story about?
Yeah, yeah. That was an early urban legend that that after the Mount St. Helens wiped out the forest, that people said they saw helicopters coming in, and that there was baskets at the bottom of the helicopters, and that there was the government secretly taking taking bodies of Bigfoot back to the Smithsonian warehouse, and you know, kind of Indiana Jones stuff was going on, they said, but. You hear this over and over again. I mean, I hear the other parts of it is, well, now since we have all this satellite technology, the government has, you know, rooms full of videos and digital recordings of Bigfoot crossing the border between Canada and the United States. And why doesn't the government release that? We've got high-definition satellites that are picking up that. And I've talked to quite a few government people. They come through the museum. I've talked to them, you know, in other ways. And one of the kind of underlying things that you see over and over again about the government is that it's not so much that they're engaged in any kind of cover-up. They're like most bureaucratic systems. They're so overwhelmed with paperwork and data that they don't even have time to look for Bigfoot. I was told by one person that, you know, that they're focusing on a certain human signature for those border crossings of the thermal imaging that is occurring across the borders. They said, if we see a moose or we see a Bigfoot and it doesn't fit with our description of what we think an Al-Qaeda would look like, that just goes in, it's erased. It's, you know, we don't have enough time to look at every possible moose that comes across the border. I mean, maybe that's how Al-Qaeda is getting into the country. They're dressing up as moose. But I think, you know, what I'm getting from all of this is that it's kind of foolish, actually, to think the government is really interested in Bigfoot. They've got their hands full with cigarette tax and liquor and Al-Qaeda and terrorists and all kinds of other things.
Yeah.
So. And I think that the eventual, what I heard about the Mount St. Helens story is something similar. The government was in there looking for bodies. They were looking for their researchers. They were looking for their geological survey individuals, and they were flying helicopters over that whole area looking for human beings.
Exactly. Yeah.
They weren't looking for Bigfoot. Most of the animals actually turned to cinders.
Yeah, that's what I was figuring. Either they ran away in time, or they you wouldn't even be able to see the body. It would be just ash and stuff. So
exactly,
it's probably like not a good place to look. What I find interesting too, we're sort of going into back to the modern era. What's going on with Bigfoot research now is that, you know, I spent a lot of time obviously on Cryptomundo, reading the articles and stuff like that. It seems like there's always some new video or something like that, but I haven't seen anything really compelling anymore because it seems like just an oversaturation of these hokey movies or bad films and blurry stuff. I mean, have you noticed this that with the rise of the camera phone and everything, it seems like there's some controversial or talked about little snippet of film every few months or something like that?
Well, I think the evolutionary decline of digital photography as evidenced by YouTube is just appalling. I mean, every other day there's a new Bigfoot video posted on YouTube. And it's they're just terrible. They're people in suits, they're people looking at a shadow on a tree and saying it's a Bigfoot. Several years ago, I think it was in 2006, I did a short history of blob squash, and that's a term that actually was coined to talk about all of these images, all of these pictures that really all they are is blobs, either frozen images or moving pictures of images that really turn out to be nothing. They turn out to be shadows, rocks, wind, and then the occasional hoaxes. Obviously, the gold standard of cryptozoological films, the Patterson-Gimlin film, has stood the test of time. And a lot of people forget about some of the other films, like the Redwoods film, the Memorial Day film, and actually one of the two individuals, Owen Platt, just recently died in a car accident. He was behind that film, the Memorial Day film. So you've got all of those other kinds of films that somewhat come up to the standard of the Bob Gimlin, Roger Patterson film. But actually the cell phones, the digital cameras, the all of those have made it not better but worse, because the Patterson film was on film. It was actually on film. And with film, we've been able to blow it up and enhance it and stabilize it. With all of these digital, you can only do so much and blow something up so big, and then it includes a lot of pixel contamination that really doesn't help us. It really hinders the analysis of these creatures on film.
Now, I'm sure you've heard about, obviously, all the different controversies surrounding the Patterson-Gimlin film, and since you mentioned it, I wanted to ask you just sort of, because we had Gian Cassar on, and he had a fairly controversial Bigfoot book that came out towards the end of last year, and he addresses a lot of these issues with the Patterson-Gimlin film sort of along the lines of the behavior of Patterson and Gimlin after they had made the movie, and how they had, I don't remember all the details off the top of my head, but how they had mailed the movie and then drove to where they had mailed it, and a lot of sort of weird things about their behavior over the course of the filming of the Bigfoot film that makes it very suspicious. What are your thoughts, I guess, on just that human element behind the film and how it makes it, in some people's eyes, you know, questionable?
I think that Monday morning quarterbacking, I think that whenever you look back historically on anything and you try to recreate it from memories over holidays, when people were mailing things, when people were had a rental camera that they turned in late, and then you know, the camera rental place sent a warrant for their arrest, and how that was overblown into someone had stolen the camera, and all of these kinds of things can all be taken out of context and really overblown. I don't think that if you look at it on an individual basis, each of these single behaviors were really nothing any more than what any of us would do if we didn't think this was going to be some kind of historical thing. You know, you put in, you take pictures, you put them, at least people used to, you put them into develop, you forget about picking them up, you rent a camera, you maybe turn it in late, you pay your library fines or you pay your fine, and you don't think about that somebody else quickly overreacted and said that you'd stole the camera.
Yeah.
So there's all of these little incidents that all put together. I mean, Roger Patterson was a very obsessed man who was a rodeo rider who wanted to make a documentary about Bigfoot. I mean, you look at why he was out there. He was out there to take a home movie about the territory where he thought there was going to be Bigfoot living. He rounds a corner and all of a sudden there's a Bigfoot there. He knew he had something, but in many ways they didn't really know what they had. You know, you look at how big that thing is on the screen. It's quite little. I've interviewed Bob Gimlin. We've got to remember that Roger Patterson's dead. He died in 1972, hardly ever making any money off this film. Got cancer, wanted to maybe do something with the film so his wife could have some kind of, you know, security after he died. He never did that. He went around, he showed it at some kind of music halls and things like that, never made any money. Bob Gimlin went back to his horse wrangling, never really thought about he was an important part of history. He didn't even start coming to Bigfoot conferences to talk to people about his experience until 2003.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't even do that until he got permission from his wife to go. And so Bob's a kind of a nice, homespun, very shy kind of guy, gets up very early at conferences, goes down to breakfast. I'm a very early riser, so in several of these conferences, Bob and I would sit there from 6 to 8 talking nonstop about what happened. And you even hear, and people come into the museum, for instance, mm-hmm. swearing that they've seen film of one of these two guys who took that film and did a deathbed confession that they said that they hoaxed the film. Now, I tell them over and over again, nothing like that ever happened. Roger Patterson died never confessing to being a hoax. I said there is one snippet of film in which Bob Gimlin is shown on camera and he is asked, did you hoax the film? He takes a deep breath and bows his head because he was so pissed off that he had to answer that question again.
Yeah.
But the editor of that film clipped it so that it looks like he's saying yes. And so it's a manipulation, it's a visual manipulation of that film. And Bob Gimlin has told people over and over again that, you know, as soon as he did that, then he said, no, you know, no way did I,
yeah,
you know, all of that. But you have this happen over and over again that people think that that's a hoax film. Actually, in my 2003 Bigfoot book, I took the three different hoax claims from 1998 to 2002 and dissected them all and showed that, for instance, the famous book by Greg Long, he, in that book, came up with two stories, one that it was a costume from this this guy in South Carolina who said he gave a gorilla suit to Patterson, and the other was that it was constructed from a red horse hide. And so a lot of us have often called Greg Long's book The Tale of Two Suits. Well, so, you know, none of these stories really, you know, they don't hold any water.
Yeah, yeah.
Lemon, there was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Two eyes, two ears, a chin, a mouth, 10 fingers, two nipples, a butt, two kneecaps, a penis. I have just described to you the Loch Ness Monster. And the reward for its capture? All the riches in Scotland. So I have one question. Why are you here?